Good day, everyone, and welcome to today's Sri Lanka Human Rights Conference call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, you will have the opportunity to ask questions during the question and answer session. You may register to ask a question at any time by pressing the star and 1 on your touch-tone phone. Please note this call is being recorded. It is now my pleasure to turn today's program over to Mr. Bill Hamilton. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you. I'm Bill Hamilton with Fenton Communications in Washington, D.C. And today's event is hosted by the Oakland Institute. The Oakland Institute is an independent policy think tank based in California, whose mission is to increase public participation and promote debate on critical social, economic, and environmental issues. It focuses in particular on human rights, land rights, and security issues. Anuradha Mittal, who is a native of India and executive director of the Oakland Institute, spent several weeks on the ground in Sri Lanka in 2014 and again earlier this year. She is the principal author of the report we'll be discussing today. I will turn the microphone over to her in a moment to summarize her findings and to introduce the other speakers. When the speakers complete their presentations, we'll open up the mic for questions. Shortly after the conference ends, we'll make available on the website of the Oakland Institute a complete transcript of this call. If after the call is over, you want additional information or have some other need, please email me at Bill, B-I-L-L, at Fenton, that's F like Frank, E-N-T-O-N, .com, Bill at Fenton.com, or call us at 202-641-0350 in the United States. And now I'm going to turn the program over to Anuradha Mittal.
Thank you, Bill, and thanks to everyone who has joined us today. I'm Anuradha Mittal, Executive Director of the Oakland Institute and the author of the reports that we released today. I will introduce the report, and then I'm joined by an eminent panel of experts, including Chief Minister Vigneswaram, first Tamil Chief Minister of Northern Province and former Supreme Court Judge of Sri Lanka, Callum McRae, the award-winning filmmaker and producer of No Fire Zone, The Killing Fields of Sri Lanka, by S.A.N. Rajkumar, a human rights activist and participant on Sri Lankan issues at the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva, and lastly by Silvaraja Senthan, editor of The Tamil Diplomat. We also have written statements from all these people, as well as the written testimony of Jayakumari Balendran, mother of a son who disappeared after surrender to the Sri Lankan army, which are being made available on our website, oaklandinstitute.org. So for our research, the goal of our research on Sri Lanka was to understand the social, economic, and political reality in the northern and eastern provinces 6 years after the conclusion of the civil war. The result is the first independent, in-depth report on post-war Sri Lanka, which exposes the following. First, in contrast with reports of peace and stability 6 years after the end of the war, the North and the East are still under very heavy military occupation, with one army personnel for every 6 civilians. This has nothing to do with ensuring security from separatist rebels. Second, the army is engaged in property development, running luxury tourist resorts, whale-watching excursions, farming, and other business ventures on land seized from local populations. Thousands of Tamil families remain displaced as their homes, schools, places of worship, and livelihoods have been razed to the ground. Third, Tamil culture and history are being systematically suppressed through Sinhalization, an orchestrated and well-resourced campaign to establish Sinhalese domination in Tamil homelands. This is a continuation of decades-long history of marginalization, which has involved violence, pogroms, repressive laws, and colonization of the North and the East. Lastly, thousands of people are missing today. While figures vary from 70,000 missing to twice that number, during the course of our fieldwork, we gathered dozens of testimonies and evidences from family members of the missing and those white-banned. All report that the search for their loved ones has been met with intimidation, threat, and even arrest. As we release this report, a key question is, how does the change of government in January 2015 impact the situation? President Sirisena has promised a process of truth and reconciliation. Some initial gestures made are, however, minimal given the extent of the problems. More important, our research and analysis raises serious questions about the government's political will and political space to carry out a thorough investigation and prosecution of war crimes and its ability to ensure remedies that lead to justice. First, no change in security status or removal of army camps is the deja vu position of Sirisena's government. In February 2015, Minister of Defense Ruwan Vijayawardene confirmed the status quo, stating that the government would not remove any army formations in the peninsula, nor does it plan to scale down security arrangements. Second, the recent appointment of Major General Diaz as the Army Chief of Staff, despite the fact that under his command the 57th Division was implicated in serious human rights abuses, rebuffs current government pledges to ensure justice and reconciliation. Third, a few political prisoners like Jayakumari Balendran have been released on conditional bail. But it remains unclear how many political prisoners are still languishing in jails and camps. Balendran's written testimony to the Oakland Institute is a direct challenge to President Sirisena's commitment. Lastly, a few lands have been released in the north and the east. For instance, President Sirisena revoked an agreement giving some 800 acres of land in Sampur to the Board of Investment, while a Navy camp is to be relocated in Sampur. Now, in case of Sampur, the new location for the Navy camp is literally just across the fence from its old location. The challenges of resettlement when little to no infrastructure remains, lands are not ready for cultivation, and land titles are not clear given communities fled under heavy shelling without papers is a huge problem. Also, people will be resettled near the proposed Indian-funded Sampur coal power plant, which is not affected by the release of these lands. Similar problems remain in the north. So the question is why we released this report today. Well, we do so to highlight the urgency of the situation. In March 2014, the United Nations Human Rights Council adopted a resolution to launch an inquiry into war crimes committed by both Sri Lankan state forces and Tamil separatist rebels. The United Nations was set to release its report in March 2015, which was delayed for 6 months at the request of the new government. Now, given the past records of government inaction, international pressure is critical for any decisive action. Instead of pursuing their geostrategic interest, United States, India, and other countries should demand the release of the UN inquiry. The Human Rights Council should focus on establishing a judicial process under the auspices of the United Nations to ensure justice is done. The human rights situation in Sri Lanka will not improve until the culture of impunity is replaced with a culture of responsibility, accountability, and fulfillment of full rights of minorities in the country. Ensuring that this happens is the responsibility and not a political dilemma of the international community. With this, I turn over to our expert panelist. Our first speaker is Chief Minister C.V. Vigneswaram, first Tamil Chief Minister of Northern Province and former Supreme Court Judge of Sri Lanka. Hello, sir, are you there?
And we have lost the Chief Minister's line. We are working to get him reconnected at this moment.
If you're waiting for that, we can turn to our next person, who is Callum McRae, a multi-award-winning filmmaker, producer of No Fire Zone, The Killing Fields of Sri Lanka.
Hello. Would you like me to go ahead and make
sure,
my statement?
Let's go ahead.
Okay. In 2009, the international community failed tragically to prevent the terrible massacres, the war crimes, the rapes and the executions, which marked the end of Sri Lanka's civil war. In doing so, it also betrayed a fundamental principle of the United Nations. And that principle is that if a state fails to protect its own people against war crimes, crimes against humanity, ethnic cleansing or genocide, or as in this case, and even worse, it is itself responsible for committing some or all of those crimes, then the international community has a duty to intervene. Now, just over a year ago, the United Nations Human Rights Council, this time in line with those principles, having failed before, concluded that because the Sri Lankan government of Mahinda Rajapaksa was clearly neither willing nor capable of carrying out its own genuine independent investigation into those crimes, then the council itself would need to institute such an inquiry. And for the first time in 5 years, the Tamils of the north and the east of Sri Lanka began to believe that a process of truth and justice might be possible. And when the people of Sri Lanka voted out the corrupt and nepotistic regime of Mahinda Rajapaksa, that felt like progress too. The new government of Maithripala Sirisena did indeed move to combat corruption and restore the rule of law. But, and it's a big but, as today's important statement, important report makes only too clear, the changes in the south are not reflected in the north. Sri Lanka still has more disappeared than any country in the world except Iraq, and that's UN figures. Only the most token plots of stolen land have been returned. And the new government has reinstated and promoted, as has just been explained, army commanders accused, not just one, not just Diaz, but others as well, accused of direct command responsibility for war crimes. So even with the best will in the world, this is not a government which is capable of running a credible domestic inquiry into the crimes of its own forces and its own officers. And this is very, very important, let alone mounting a judicial process which would have that essential quality, the trust of the victims. The trust of the victims being an essential for any such process. So in that sense, I'm afraid nothing has changed since the UN set up the inquiry a year ago. Talk of a new domestic inquiry misses the point completely. The fact is that the international inquiry has been completed. It will be presented in September, and then the Human Rights Council must start the process of establishing a judicial process under international UN control to ensure that justice is done.
Thank you, Callum. Do we have the Chief Minister back?
Yes, I'm now here.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you. So please go ahead, sir.
Well, I would say the wording on the cover page of the Auckland Institute publication, which says the long shadow of war, the struggle for justice in post-war Sri Lanka, more or less summarizes the predicament of our people in the northern province in Sri Lanka. That means the shadow of war has extended for 6 years. We have, during this period, struggled for justice in post-war Sri Lanka. It was 4 years after the end of the war that the northern province had occasion to elect its provincial administration. Then again, in your the cover page, there's an interesting thing. It drives slow troops ahead on the cover page. It is symbolic of our tardy progress even after election. The presence of a large contingent of military, alleged to be around 150,000, who might mostly be those who committed the war crimes, restricts our progress. There are many matters to discuss. The military taking over of lands, taking over our houses, farms, businesses, dealing in large-scale property developments, construction projects, touring activities, and whatnot. They help the fishermen from other provinces to come over and indulge in illegal fishing methods. The colonization of northern provincial lands with persons from outside the province of different ethnicity is also because of the help that the government gives. This disturbs the demography of the area. Now, there are very many matters like this which needs to be discussed, and I'm not too sure whether I have overstepped the 1 minute that was given to me. I shall be most glad to help any questions that may be posed together to me. Thank you.
Thank you, Chief Minister. Our next speaker is S.N. Rajkumar, a human rights defender and participant on Sri Lankan issues at the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva.
Thank you, Anuradha. Thank you all. I'll just focus on my statement and then come back to about the report. Everyone is concerned about the delay of the UN report on war crimes in Sri Lanka, but the real worry should be about the action that follows the release of the report in September 2015. The mandated report was delayed in March 2015 in the aftermath of the regime change in Sri Lanka on 8th of January 2015. Delay of the report sets a wrong precedent. UN mandates cannot be maneuvered around electoral politics of a country in question. The regime change in Sri Lanka has helped some geopolitical interest in the region, but it seriously falls short of delivering justice and accountability to the victims.
The failure of the United Nations to protect civilians during the last phase of the war in Sri Lanka resulted in 146,679 Tamils still not unaccounted for. Now the UN and the international community has a second chance to rectify its own failings in Sri Lanka during the final phase of the war in 2009. There is a talk of a domestic mechanism to carry out the investigations in Sri Lanka, but Sri Lanka does not have the will or the capacity to conduct a domestic investigation due to various factors, which are mainly alleged war criminals are still hold public offices, the constitution or the penal system does not recognize war crimes, crimes against humanity or genocide as a crime under the domestic law. Hence, past crimes cannot be prosecuted. Most of the atrocities and the crimes are committed against Tamils, and the Tamil people, the sole victims or the main victims, have lost faith and trust of the Sri Lankan legal system. In Sri Lanka, justice can only be served by establishing an international tribunal to investigate all atrocities and war crimes committed by all parties. I welcome the report by Auckland Institute. It clearly depicts the current dire situation in the island of Sri Lanka. Land was a key factor in Sri Lankan civil war. It is still vital, or it is vital to understand the underlying issues around land when addressing political issues in the country. Ethnocratic land grabs and forced democratic alterations must be stopped for peaceful coexistence of all ethnic groups in the island of Sri Lanka. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Rajkumar. And our last expert on the panel is Silva Rajasenthan, editor of the Tamil Diplomat.
Thank you, Alvada. Beyond various genocidal strategies, land grabs have been fundamental to the oppression of the Tamil people in Sri Lanka since independence in 1948. The test of resources, land and livelihoods is, however, quite often hidden. There is an urgent need to understand land-related issues to comprehend the consequences of land grabs in the long term. Land grabs are just as violent building injustice and exploitation into a social system. Lack of understanding of land grabs as the oppressive mechanism of the successive Sri Lankan governments against the Tamil people in the north and the east is one of the primary reasons for the failure of the international community to bring about accountability and justice for the Tamil people in Sri Lanka. This lack of understanding of land issues as a source of conflict is a result of successful propaganda strategy of the successive Sri Lankan governments to delegitimize the problems of the Tamils and justify the war, paving the way for the international community to fail in its legal and moral considerations and responsibility. Today, media and research institutes need to play an important role to influence the international community to prevent further human rights violations by establishing a regime of truth to depoliticize the application of human rights instruments. Production and dissemination of information on oppression, suppression, and injustice through critical research serves to assess the true situation of human rights of states. In other words, it calls for the establishment of a prima facie case for a legitimate intervention on the part of the international community. Within this context, I hope the report of Auckland Institute will be a useful reference work for all, but especially those investigating the war crimes and human rights situation in post-war Sri Lanka. This study is particularly welcome since its findings are well documented and empirically established, and that it is one of the very few investigative reports conducted on land issues in Sri Lanka by an independent research organization outside of Sri Lanka. Thank you.
Thank you, Senthan. And again, these statements are available on the website of the AucklandInstitute.org on Sri Lanka pages.
Priscilla, I think that's it.
Okay, certainly. Hello. At this time, if you would like to ask a question, you may do so by pressing the star and 1 on your touch-tone telephone. You may withdraw your question at any time by pressing the pound key. Once again, if you would like to ask a question, please press the star and 1 on your touch-tone phone. We will take our first question from Mr. Ramakrishnan with Hindu Times. Your line is open.
Good evening. I have two questions. Either this can be addressed by Ms. Anuradha Mittal or Mr. Vigneswaran. Is there any international example wherein much more progress has happened under similar circumstances within a few months of the existence of a government? And number two, is the institute trying to be hypercritical of a new regime? Thank you.
Thank you. I can address the second question if, Chief Minister, if you want to address the question first.
Well, I was not quite certain about what he was trying to find out. Is it that there has been any country where so much has been done within a short period of their coming to power? Is that what he is trying to say?
Yes.
Well, I don't think I would be in a position to answer that very much because I have not done a comparative study as such. So I think you go ahead with the, I think you may have to answer both with your knowledge.
Well, to address your question, I think this is not really a comparison of what has happened, and the Institute is definitely not being hypercritical given the government has been in power only since January. But we are highlighting that the so-called efforts that have been made are very minimal, and we need to acknowledge them, that they are minimal. There is a lot of welcoming of the new government. There has been a lot of change in the United States, India, and other countries' approach to this administration, and there's a lot of belief and faith. But we have to look at the facts. The facts are that this is an administration which talked about putting the process in place in April, nor it is talking about putting the process in place in June. So we can continue delaying, and we can continue to look the other way. So all that the Institute is trying to do is to put pressure that we do not forget that people, communities, hundreds of thousands of people are waiting for justice.
May I also add to that, with regard to the hypocritical aspect of the question that was asked, because as far as we are concerned, there were certain minimal things which we wanted. Now, for example, with regard to the land that had to be released, first, when they said it was 1,000-odd acres, only 400 acres was given. They took quite a long time to give the 1,000-odd acres, but that the lands that were given were not fertile. They were just lands which were not really useful to the people. And so the type of things that has been stated as far as the Tamils are concerned, as far as the minorities are concerned, there had not been the will to help us except unless they are forced to do so. And this has been one of the characteristics of what has been taking place. The central government in Sri Lanka will not do anything towards the minorities or towards the Tamils unless they are forced to do something. So the fact that that you are bringing out these matters into the open by the Auckland Institute is definitely useful in order to bring about the international pressure that is necessary in with regard to a government of this sort. Thank you.
And as a reminder. Sorry, as a reminder, if you would like to ask a question during today's conference, please press the star and 1 on your touch-tone telephone. We'll pause for a moment to allow further questions to queue.
Hello, can anyone hear me?
Yeah, I could.
I'm just wondering, if while we were waiting, I had a brief comment to make as well, just while we were waiting for another question.
Sure.
It's just picking up on the question that was made. I think it's very important to distinguish between the progress which has been made in the South, as it were, and the progress which has been made in the North. I think that the danger is that the world is very much seeing genuine progress, which is very much to be welcomed in terms of the restoration of the rule of the law, to a degree the freedom of the press. But the problem is that there is a huge disjunct between what is being done in the South. In a sense, you are seeing democracy being reintroduced for the people of the South and for the singular majority, but you are not seeing the same thing happening in the North. And it is very important to distinguish between the very significant achievements of the government in the South and, I'm afraid, the serious failures of the government to make any serious changes on what are the fundamental and most important issues for Sri Lanka, which is the question of truth and justice and political solutions in the North. Those are the most important questions that that country and that government faces, and it is on those that I'm afraid it is failing to make anything like the progress that it is making in other issues.
Thank you. We will take our next question from Elizabeth Fraser with the Oakland Institute. Your line is open.
Great. Thank you so much for taking my call. I have two questions. The first one is I'm wondering if someone could speak to what the expectations are for the domestic investigation that is set to begin in June. And secondly, what you see the role of the international community being coming out of this report, what you think the role of the international community needs to be in terms of bringing justice to the northern and the eastern provinces of Sri Lanka. Thank you.
Chief Minister, if you want to address the question around expectations and around what the domestic for the domestic process.
Could you explain that, because if you follow the question, is it possible for you to explain?
I'm sorry, the line was breaking up and I didn't hear what the question was.
I think if you could repeat the question around the domestic...
I think they should repeat the question, yes, please.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I'm just wondering what you expect from the domestic investigation that's set to begin in June, what your expectations are of that process and the potential outcomes.
Well, with regard to the domestic investigations, right at the beginning there is a lot of shortcomings because we are not quite certain that the domestic investigations would be able to bring about the expected results, because a number of things which have preceded has to be taken into account. There had been international experts which were brought in with regard to an investigation earlier where it was found that there was conflict of interest with regard to the those who prosecuted at the inquiry, and also looked after the interests of the state as well as the people who were found who were accused of the offences. So right at the beginning, we have had a number of cases in the past where there had not been proper investigations that had taken place. So as far as this is concerned, a domestic inquiry will not be to the will not bring about the necessary expected results. And I agree that there should be an international dimension to the investigative process. Otherwise, I do not think we could expect very much out of any domestic investigative process at all.
And to answer the second question, if Senthan or Rajkumar, or if you would like to respond, what is the role of the international community and what we can do?
Yeah, this is Rajkumar. I think it's very important to look at the UN's role, because the UN's role during the conflict and then the end of the conflict was very kind of passive. And then afterwards, there was activism and in terms of looking into the probe. But then after the regime change, it looks like they have actually lost steam. Because one, the report, they all talk about the report, the actual the recommendations of the report is going to vary in such a way. Secondly, what actions is going to follow afterwards? Thirdly, none of us are critical about the new regime, but what we are actually looking forward is lack of action. I mean, if there is any action that should translate in terms of this. But the key things that I would like to stress from my statement again
Sri Lanka cannot actually do an internal investigation as long as they haven't actually included, or as long as they haven't completely restructured or changed their constitution, because currently the constitution does not look into war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide, because that is what the charge which we are putting forward.
Thank you. And as a reminder, if you would like to ask a question, please press the star and one on your touchtone phone. We'll take our next question from Elizabeth Kennedy, an independent diplomat. Your line is open.
Hi. Thank you so much for giving me this opportunity. I noticed in the beginning that you mentioned the military still has significant commercial interests in the North and East. How do these commercial interests impact the release of land and resettlement?
How does the, could you repeat that part?
Sorry. How do the military's commercial interests, such as in the tourism industry and the mining industry, prevent the release of land and the resettlement of land for the Tamil people?
Well, I'm not too sure that I understood your question.
For instance, Hotel Thalsavana, I mean, when the military has built these holiday resorts, how will those lands be released to the people of Palali, for instance?
Yes, exactly. Now, that is exactly the point. Now, as far as there had been a seven-star hotel that was built by the previous president, and I had occasion to visit it with the present president, and he said, well, if necessary, we are prepared to hand it over to the Northern Provincial Council to run it as an international conference hall and for various other things. Now, as things are, it is all completely in the hands of the army, in the hands of the military, and most of these lands, you will find that the original landholders or the owners of the houses, they do not now see the houses there. It has been completely brought down. So the manner in which, as things are, it appears that the army had taken full control and have no idea at all of returning them to the owners. So that is the present position. Even the lands that had been released are unfertile lands, but those which had been the good fertile lands are still being cultivated by the army. And I have my doubts that the army would like to ever leave those areas. And with regard to the business aspect of it, they are doing so much of businesses around there. They have taken complete control of the economic activities in the north in those areas, bringing in people from outside with regard to the fisheries to do illegal fishing. That is, Sinhalese people from the down south have been brought in to do illegal fishing, and the people of the area, when they have to do fishing, they are not allowed to do the fishing. They are chased away by the army or the navy. So that is the present position.
If I might add to that, Elizabeth, I think that is a very important question. And as the Chief Minister said, this talk of handing over, say, the seven-star hotel to the Northern Provincial Council. But in our report, we detail the lives of the people who have been living in these welfare centers or these internally displaced people's camps for over 20, 25 years. These are people who will not be able to go back. And as pointed out, in Sampur as well, houses were destroyed after the war was over. If you look at the maps, houses, homes, schools, they were all destroyed after the end of the war. And if people and lands are released, in addition to infertile lands, there's no structure for these people to go back to. So that is why this report and the pressure again, as to not just make these minimal, efforts, but to actually move in. Secondly, the issue is, given that there has been no healing of the country, given the, this conflation of land, race, identity around a Sinhala nation, till that is dealt with, I don't think any president has the political will or the political space to be able to challenge the army, which has taken over these resources. As our report points, over 160,000 people that are sitting in the north, the army personnel. How would you move them and make them give away what they have enjoyed for so long?
Exactly. This is primarily the primary question is that because the information that we had was when the government wanted to hand over 1,000 acres of land, but only 400 was given when the president and the prime minister came over. It was simply that the army refused to give the balance land. Then it was by a process of various processes that they were able to increase it from 400 to 1,000 acres. But in fact, we were expecting 5,500 acres to be returned out of a total of 6,500 acres. So you're quite right. There is no question of the army having got used to all the benefits of having been there would like to leave the area. So unless there is some pressure from the international arena, there is going to be difficulties of our being able to do anything.
Could I possibly interject briefly as well, just in support of what the Chief Minister is saying? The problem is that Sri Lanka, I'm afraid, in its current situation, is incapable, and this is the point, of organizing a process of truth-telling and justice, which A, works on its own level, and B, and equally importantly, has the trust of the victims. It is not possible for it to do that with the best will in the world, and there are plenty of people in the new government who would like to see progress on this, but with the best will in the world, it is not capable of doing it. And that's why the international community has this huge responsibility. Now, the international community accepted its responsibility when it instituted the inquiry. It accepted that Sri Lanka was not capable or willing of doing the inquiry, which is essential if there is to be peace and political progress and reconciliation. And nothing, I'm afraid, has significantly changed since then. The new government is actually, for all the best its intentions, is not actually capable of offering a process of independent justice, independent truth-telling, which has the confidence of all the communities. And that's why the international community still has the obligation. It accepted a year ago. It still has that obligation to ensure that it institutes a process of truth-telling and justice. And if the international community fails to recognize it still has that responsibility, then it will be a failure which will compound the terrible, appalling failure that it did in 2009 when it let these massacres happen.
Thank you. We'll now take a question from Kanya De Almeida with IPS. Your line is open.
Thank you, and thank you so much to everyone on the call. This is Kanya De Almeida from IPS. My question really goes to the number of troops and the number of displaced. There appears to be so many conflicting numbers on that, and I was just wondering if there has been any change in the number of troops since the election of President Maithripala Sirisena, and the same for the number of displaced. Has there been a significant change or any significant impact to resettle that has been reflected in actual numbers on the ground in the north and the east?
Well, I would find it difficult to exactly tell you about numbers. There had been a general call on the army to get back to their barracks, and therefore there was no ostensible presence of the army except recently when there were some problems. But there had been no sort of exodus of soldiers from the northern province which was perceivable by anybody. So though they are talking in terms of reduction and so on, but what really happens is some of the camps are closed up and they are put into another larger camp and they get in there. So I do not think there had been any significant reduction with regard to the number of soldiers, but this is a matter which needs more research, because I may not be in a position to quite answer that properly. But this is on a general understanding of what is taking place. This is what I could say.
And Kanya, I'm not sure if you were on the call when I made my statement, but in February 2015, Minister of Defense Ruwan Vijayawardene confirmed he was speaking to the tri-service troops in Jaffna headquarters, and he stated that the government would not remove any army formations in the peninsula, nor does it plan to scale down security arrangements. So if you go to the Ministry of Defense pages and you look at what they're telling the troops to pacify them, that is a serious concern for us, because they're making commitments that we would not take away any welfare benefits from you. We are going to keep these army formations in the northern province. And also I want to mention that just recently on May 19th, despite these efforts of reconciliation, the victory parade was still organized, which was about remembering the defense forces, but forgot to remember the civilians, you know, thousands of civilians who lost their lives in the shelling, as pointed out by Callum and other panelists. Any event that was organized to remember, you know, the civilians, the death and the carnage that happened, there was a very heavy presence of police, as well as, you know, an intimidating presence of the police and the army there in, at the event.
Yeah, added to this, Anuradha, there's, even just 2 days after the 8th of January, I had occasion to meet the Prime Minister, who had been just installed as Prime Minister, and he made a definite statement that he was going to tell the Buddhist priests that not a single army camp in the northern province was going to be taken away from there. And that was thereafter stated by Ruan Vijayawardena. So you're quite right that there is no intention on the part of the government to remove them, though sometimes various statements are made. But so we had been always watching on the lookout to see whether there is any mass exodus of any soldiers. We found none. So definitely what I said earlier is correct. Sometimes a few camps are closed up, but all the soldiers are taken over to a larger camp, and they are still continuing to be there. So the chances are over 150,000 soldiers are still there in the northern province.
Thank you. And we have no further questions at this time. I'll turn the call back to Mr. Hamilton for closing remarks.
Thank you. So I just want to repeat that the Oakland Institute website will have a complete transcript of this call in about an hour on their website. And if after the call is over you need additional information or have some other question, if you will contact me, bill@fenton.com, or call the United States number 202-641-0350. We'll do our best to accommodate you. Thank you for participating, and thank you for Oakland Institute for a terrific presentation. Goodbye.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.